A host of budget travel shows tells us what her priorities are as a Black woman who often travels solo. And we'll check with more listeners on how they're avoiding the crowds at popular tourist sites now that the whole world is traveling again. That's in the hour ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. Europe is home to about 24 official languages, and many more regional ones that may still be spoken today. While languages die out all the time, knowing how one language became dominant over the others can help you understand the history and character of any society. And it can help you notice when the minority languages start to make a comeback. Joining us is Dr. Ross Perlin. He teaches linguistics at Columbia University and co-founded the nonprofit Endangered Language Alliance. They help document, map, and preserve languages that are at risk of disappearing. He joins us from his office in New York City. Ross, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, I'm just fascinated by a linguist, and a lot of us don't really appreciate or understand what a linguist does. Tell us, what is a linguist?
I wish it was somebody who just got to learn languages, because I do love learning languages, and people always ask, oh, how many do you speak? But linguists also have a responsibility to think about language more broadly, research theories of language, try to understand principles of language more generally. And my particular specialty within it is endangered languages, especially of the Himalaya, but I've also worked in Europe and other places and have a base here in New York City, the most multilingual city in the history of the world, where languages come from all over.
And you just wrote a book called Language City, which is all about the fight to preserve endangered mother tongues in New York. Now, you mentioned that people ask you, how many languages do you speak? And I know that you've written that that's something that linguists do not like to be asked. Well, first of all, why not? And how many languages do you speak?
Well, I guess the reason why not is just because linguistics is about more than that. And it's not about just sort of enumerating and bagging languages. And as in my case, yes, I think I counted, I've studied, you know, 15 or something like that and right. Have varying degrees of knowledge of them. But like anybody, they come and go or I know them in different ways. So it's about language as part of lived experience, I think, is an important thing to remember.
I know from reading your book that there's new schools of linguistics and so on. And you're what I think would be called a radical linguist. The only other linguist I've ever known is, of course, Noam Chomsky. And you wrote kind of humorously that he's a radical, but he's not a radical linguist. what is the difference between your focus on linguistics and Chomsky's?
So, you know, Noam Chomsky, in terms of his linguistic work, which is pretty different in many ways from his political writings, comes along in the 1950s and 1960s and really changes the field with the sort of idea of searching for linguistic universals. And of course, there's a lot more to it there, but It by and large sort of bypasses actually existing linguistic diversity and the imperative to document the, you know, more than half of the world's languages, which are little documented and are highly endangered. So the focus of the sort of, you could say, radical linguistics that I have been part of is really in the last couple of decades of stressing that actually this diversity is being lost. We need to really recognize and document all the differences and take them seriously and actually appreciate and celebrate that. And yes, where there are commonalities, we can look at those too, but those actually, in some cases, pale before the immense differences and fascinating different ways that we communicate with each other.
And talking about, you know, the fascinating history and story of languages as they relate to peoples and cultures, this is a travel show. I focus on Europe in my teaching, and Europe to me is just a fascinating story of bully tribes and weak tribes and pushing and pulling, and that would show itself today in the linguistic map of Europe. If you were to look at the political map of Europe and the linguistic map of Europe, they would be different, wouldn't they?
Those are very different maps, and I think the linguistic map is the deeper one that really gets you into European history, European culture. You know, whether if you want to go to the Basque country, you go to the Dolomites, you go to Istria, or any number of places, these are multilingual spaces where if you really want to understand what's going on, you need to understand who are the Basques, what is their language, what is the Ladin language that's spoken in some of those Dolomite and Alpine regions, you know, what is multilingual Istria? This is really the deeper view on what's happening, and it gets into the food, the dress, the music, but language is the lens.
I think when you look at Europe, there's like 24 official languages. There's five languages that really are dominant. I think there's five languages that are spoken by over 50 million people. But if you look at the little languages, which are a few of those that you find interesting as a linguist?
Well, one of the places I've worked in Europe is Istria, the Istrian Peninsula, which is part of Croatia, but very close to Italy. And it's one of the most multilingual places that I've been. Everybody's speaking four or five languages. And I worked there a little bit with what people know as the Italian community, which is considered by some, you know, sort of ethnically Italian, but actually speak a native language called Istrioto. And this is the original language of Istria. It's a Romance language, but pretty different maybe from some of the other ones you know. And then many speak Istro-Veneto, which is a dialect of the Venetian language, because Istria was under Venetian control for almost 1,000 years. And then on top of that, people may speak standard Italian too, because the Istria did spend some time as part of Italy, and Italian was brought in, and there are ties there. And then, of course, there's Croatian, specifically the sort of Western dialects of Croatian, since this became part of Croatia. And, you know, of course, then there's English and German that people also speak, but that's just one example of how multilingual a place can be.
And that is it a coincidence that that happens to be where three giant linguistic families come together? You got the Romance languages, you got the Germanic language, and you got the Slavic languages, right?
That's true. It is kind of a fulcrum, so it is a pretty unique place. And that's, you know, an important thing to remember is that, yeah, these language families interweave in such fascinating ways. You know, there are certain regions like the Balkans that linguists just love to look at because it represents a kind of meeting point as well of all these different languages and how they influence each other. And actually, even in a single language, you can see the grammar coming from different families.
And Ross, as a linguist, do you look at some languages that you just think, oh yeah, barbarian hordes, you know, like Hungary, right? Hungary is just a weird language as far as what are the other languages around it. It's not related to any of these. And you can trace it back, and it was a bunch of nomadic warriors that eventually said, oh, this is a nice place. Let's settle down.
Yeah, the history of Hungarian is certainly a fascinating one. And of course, it then links you to the history of Finnish, right? These are related, Finnish and Hungarian and Estonian. And then if you look at what are the related languages, you're going deep into Russia. And there's a bunch of, you know, endangered, little known languages that are part of that same family. And so then to piece together that archipelago is to understand something pretty fundamental about, you know, European history, really Eurasian history. You sort of see those connections of Eurasia as a whole, which, you know, of course, Europe is this fascinating peninsula or world of Western Eurasia, but it's linked to all these other places as well. It's part of a global history.
Ross Perlin's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves as we look at how understanding the role of Europe's many languages can help you better appreciate its distinct cultures. Ross is the author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. In it, he explores how New York is the most linguistically diverse city in history. Ross has also been co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance since 2013, where he manages projects on urban linguistic diversity. There's more about their work at elaalliance.org. Ross, I'm fascinated by the survival, frankly, of these small languages that are bullied by the big languages. And when we think in Europe, what are a couple of languages that are regional, that are not national languages, that you think are healthy?
Well, some of the best-known cases are Welsh, which has held on in northern Wales in amazing ways. In Spain, you're looking at Basque and Catalan in particular, which have stabilized and even mounted revivals. And there are other cases around as well. These stories are pretty amazing.
And those are hard-fought successes from a linguistic point of view. I mean, Catalonian people, they'll fall on their sword for their language. I mean, they were really brutalized by Franco, and now they can wave the Catalonian flag, and they can speak their language at school, and it can be the first language of that part of Spain.
Yeah, it's really the story of Spanish history, that this was a pretty federal place that had these deeply regional identities from long ago. Franco tries to suppress that and make everyone Castilian, but that's not what people wanted.
Aren't you impressed by the feistiness and the durability of these linguistic groups? They don't just roll over and teach their kids to speak the dominant language.
Well, Basque is a particularly extraordinary case, right? This survived, you know, the Roman Empire. It survived Ferdinand and Isabella. But similarly, the Celtic languages, whether it's Welsh or Irish or Scottish Gaelic, I mean, they have survived thousands of years.
Well, let's have a moment of silence for Cornish.
Oh, that's right, Cornish. Although there are people reviving it, actually, and Manx as well from the Isle of Man.
Is that right?
That language is another Celtic one being revived, so the story may not be over.
Well, Ireland has actually subsidized the survival of traditional Irish language on the West in Gaeltachts, national parks for the survival of the language, frankly.
that's what they are. And, you know, Ireland has had its independence now for a century. And, you know, I know many hoped for the language to be revived even more, but a whole new world of second language speakers has been created. Mm-hmm. Irish has a big place in, you know, the national culture. And those Gaeltachts in Western Ireland, I mean, they're some of the most extraordinary, beautiful, and culturally rich and interesting places around.
You know, that leads me to just wonder about the complexities and the disadvantages or the hardship caused by multilingual countries. I mean, Belgium is a good example. They have a hard time with its split between French-speaking Walloons and Dutch-speaking Flemish people, right?
It's interesting. I mean, you can look at a place like Belgium where, from what I understand, you know, there is some of that tension there, right? And some would say, you know, maybe that they will split up. You know, part of what I understand in Belgium was that it was the way that French was put on top that has led to some of the resentments and issues now. So, but then you can look at a case like Switzerland where it's very successfully multilingual. And it sort of depends on how you manage it. I think in and of itself, it's not necessarily a problem.
Ross, I just want to finish talking about the nonprofit organization that you are the co-director of, the Endangered Language Alliance. What is the mission of the Endangered Language Alliance, and what is its perspective on Europe?
So we're a unique organization based here in New York, founded in 2010. I tell the story of it in my book, Language City, which doubles as a linguistic history of New York. A lot of people forget about the European linguistic diversity in New York City, which has been here now for four centuries. And virtually every European language, including all these minority languages, has been spoken here, including all the ones we've mentioned. There's a church where the services are in Welsh. There's a Basque club. There's a Catalan literature festival. All of these languages are actually here. So in some ways, you know, if you can't get over to Europe at some point or you just want a taste of it and you're in New York, you can find it here.
Ross Perlin, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your work, inspiring and encouraging us to be a little more multilingual in our outlook.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Dr. Ross Perlin is the author of Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. He's also written Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. A list of Ross's upcoming appearances is on his website, rossperlin.com. Up next, travel host Onika Raymond shares what it's like to travel beyond your time zone and your comfort zone as a Black woman traveling solo. And listeners tell us how they've been avoiding the overcrowding of bucket list destinations to enjoy their own corners of Europe this year. It's Travel with Rick Steves.